We usually only notice mucus when it's causing a problem, with a runny nose, a cold, or allergies. That's when our nose runs, our airways feel congested, and our body visibly produces more of it. Yet mucus isn't just a symptom of illness, it's a permanent part of our mucous membranes, and an important protective barrier against infections. Even when we're healthy, the body produces up to 1.5 liters of mucus a day. It carries away dirt, bacteria, old cells, and viruses, and makes it harder for pathogens to make initial contact with our cells. It is precisely this early phase of an infection that Professor Christian Sieben and his nano-infection biology research group at the HZI are studying. Using specialized microscopy, his team investigates how individual viral particles interact with mucosal cells, how they bind to cells, and what role the mucus barrier plays in this process. The goal is to understand how viruses overcome this natural protective layer, and how this process can be specifically disrupted. In this episode of In Fact, our host, Julia Demann, talks to Professor Sieben about how this research could lead to new approaches for vaccines, antiviral drugs, and better preparation for future waves of infection.
I'm sitting here in Cologne and I'm talking now to Professor Christian Sieben in Braunschweig at the HZI. Hi.
Hi. Hi, Julia. Good morning.
Christian, nano-infection biology involves working with extremely small particles. You use a microscope to examine how individual viruses attack our cells and what individual proteins do in this process. Why do you choose this challenge? I think there are much easier things to look at under a microscope.
Yeah, that's true. But we typically use microscopes to study small things. So I've always looked at cells. So I started with plant cells, plant cell biology, and then started to work on mammalian cells and viruses. And that was really a fascinating transition, sort of to see a virus, like a little dot, infecting a live cell. So looking under the microscope and seeing how cells, you know, behave and what they do is already quite interesting. But once we infect them, it's a whole new kind of fascination. And that's why we stuck to it. And then we started to focus even on things that are smaller than viruses, because that's what matters for them. So we wanted to understand. So we want to understand what happens at the scale of an infecting virus. And viruses are small, so they only have a few proteins to interact with the target cell. And we want to understand exactly what happens in this little patch of cell that is in contact with the virus.
And what magnifications do you use? And what do you see there?
So we use light microscopes. So they have typically 1,000 or 2,000-fold magnification. So for comparison, maybe like a school microscope or one that you would have at home has a couple hundred fold magnification, maybe 400 or 500. So that is already enough to see individual cells. So we have a bit more. And that is enough. And then it's a sort of a specific branch of light microscopy, that is fluorescence microscopy, where we label individual structures so that we can see them with very high contrast, like they carry a little light torch. That is what, so for example, how we look at viruses. So they have a little light torch so we can see them in the dark. Then we have a specific sort of expertise on super resolution microscopy technologies, and those allow us then to go even further down with conventional light microscopes to see individual molecules, basically, which is super cool. So you can see individual molecules kind of moving around inside live cells, and then we see the virus, let's see, in another color, and we can detect and quantify how individual receptor proteins, for example, interact with an infecting virus and what happens next.
Yeah, and what happens next? What happens when viruses enter the cell?
Yeah, so that is also something that we want to understand. So we look at the cell surface, the plasma membrane, viruses bind to receptors, and then there's somehow the virus needs to signal into the cell, right? The virus needs to tell the cell, look, I'm here, I want to enter. The plasma membrane is a barrier virus cannot get over so easily. So we want to understand how this signal is transmitted and how the cell understands the virus. It has never seen a virus before, right? So, but from a molecular point of view, these are signaling cascades. So receptors become activated. So they change. They become modified. The cell detects this modification and performs a certain action. The viruses enter. They deliver their genome and then make the cell basically to produce viral proteins.
Which viruses are you examining then?
So we work on respiratory viruses. So we have a long-standing expertise on influenza, and we started to work on respiratory syncytial virus recently here at HZI, RSV. And in a more recent project since last year, we also work on Marburg virus, that is a highly pathogenic virus, a highly pathogenic filovirus, that where we have low biosafety model systems to study the cell biology of these viruses.
When we look at larger scale, many researchers say that influenza viruses pose the highest risk for the next pandemic. What makes influenza viruses so dangerous?
So influenza viruses, they're very variable. They have a very high genetic diversity, very high mutation rate. So no virus is basically exactly identical to the other virus in nature. And then the lab is a little bit different. So that is one aspect. So that our immune system needs to adapt every time it sees an influenza virus to this new strain or new variant. This is one aspect, and there's a quite large animal reservoir where these viruses constantly circulate and again constantly evolve. So one needs to have a close kind of surveillance of these animal reservoirs to know which strains currently circulate and in which animals they circulate, because there might be these spillover events in other populations and also into livestock, for example, which is quite critical. And then maybe the third sort of risk or like a characteristic of influenza is that it is a respiratory pathogen, and those viruses just transmit easier than other viruses that need kind of close contact or other means. So it has it checks a couple of boxes that would make it could make it a pandemic virus.
Okay, yeah, and we have an annual vaccine, a flu vaccine, you just said that they are very variable, and I think this is one reason why the vaccine doesn't protect against all influenza viruses or strains, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. So the viruses are very dynamic, they mutate, we say they drift, they have a genetic drift. When it comes to the seasonality of influenza, one has to make a certain kind of look into the future prediction of which virus strain might circulate in a certain area in the next winter season and then make that respective vaccine. So that is, there's some uncertainty there. But there's research to overcome this, of course. So there's many people working on vaccines that try to prevent infection or disease of a large diversity of different influenza virus strains. And they do this by focusing on sort of conserved epitopes, so parts of the virus that are not so variable, because it's only some parts of the viruses that change all the time. Some parts the viruses cannot change, then they wouldn't be infectious anymore. So they keep it constant. We say conserved. And if we could target those conserved parts, we would have a very effective vaccine that would protect against a large number of different influenza virus strains.
Is it even possible to develop vaccines or medications, for example, against influenza virus infections that can be quickly adapted in an emergency?
So vaccines, yes. We have seen this also during Corona. For therapeutics, it's much harder because the development of therapeutics is already a quite long process. And also the identification of targets, the identification of really antiviral mechanisms is a much longer process. So that is, I think, is harder. But yes, there's, of course, a large, group of people who work on antiviral development. So we are also involved in projects to do this. There's one example. We have one collaboration with one of the partner institutes of HZI, the HIPS in Saarbrücken, where we want to develop adhesion inhibitors, so new sort of glycan-based inhibitors that, for example, could prevent virus cell binding. So that is something that could be prepared kind of in advance against newly or upcoming viruses. But yeah, otherwise it's hard to really specifically or in advance develop kind of antiviral drugs that could fit to a newly emerging virus. So I think the vaccines are the faster mechanism there.
And how do you know which structures the active ingredients need to target?
Yeah, so they're on the viral side. This can be sort of tested. Many antiviral drugs target viral enzymes, for example, or the replication machinery. In our case, as I said, we focus on virus cell binding. So we try to develop competitive binding inhibitors, so try to prevent kind of synthetic particles that viruses like to bind and that bind more efficiently than the cell surface. So we can prevent a very early interaction. And when it comes to the cellular side, so there we have also ongoing projects. We have launched an EU-wide project last year. It's called Combine, which has the virus cell binding and cell entry phase in its sort of scientific focus. And we want to develop new pipelines to quickly identify virus interacting factors and cellular factors that are important for virus infection. So this is one aspect there to be, if a new pathogen, let's say, comes up, pathogen X, we have a pipeline to, under high biocontainment, interrogate that specific pathogen and identify cellular factors that are involved in virus infection. So that we know how we can look maybe into a catalog of drugs. Do we have something that targets that particular protein? We can use that to against this virus or against the disease. And we have another sort of branch in this project where we want to also identify antiviral drugs, small molecule drugs. That is another collaboration here at HZI where we use Marburg virus as a model. So on this project we use Marburg virus because it's a highly pathogenic virus that is only handled under high biosafety containment that we don't have here actually at HZI. So we use other model systems, surrogate systems, but we want our pipelines and our workflows to be ready for this high biocontainment. So all assays we develop are sort of ready to use in this biocontainment for pathogen X.
Very interesting. But let's stay at the respiratory viruses. Before such a virus can infect us, they first have to pass through our mucous membranes. You are also looking into how they do that. And in a brand new research project, you do this. How do they get through this mucus?
That is a very interesting point. So yeah, as you say, our respiratory tract is lined with a thin layer of this mucus, which is kind of a viscous gel that is kept under flow by ciliary movements. So our cells have kind of small extensions, little fingers, and they move the mucus constantly. So that's kind of moved out of the way, and it can really trap particles, anything that we inhale, and move it away from our respiratory cells to protect. So, and it is a really effective barrier that prevents really irritation and infections all the time. So in this new project, which is called OneMUC, that we started just this year, we want to understand this barrier from a zoonotic perspective. So we have a zoonotic transmission, so viruses that spill over from an animal reservoir like influenza. So there we want to study if the animal mucus is different from the human mucus, and if viruses are sort of adapted to interact and penetrate the respective mucus barrier more efficiently. And ideally then downstream, which molecular characteristics and which molecular factors are responsible for a better or worse interaction with viruses, so that we can ideally maybe test for this specific property of mucus or even change it in the future.
And in this project, you are working together with the research group of Dr. Julia Port, transmission immunology. And I talked to her about viruses spread like mpox. Feel free to give it a listen, season 2, episode 2. It was really, really interesting. But back to the mucus, what is the goal of these studies? Do we need more mucus?
So more mucus is probably not so good. So there are some kind of diseases like cystic fibrosis, for example, where the mucus is very thick, and that is very difficult for those patients. But it's more about the properties of the mucus. So those we want to understand from a molecular virology and biochemical point of view. So what is in the mucus? Proteins, glycans, antibodies, and what are the biophysical properties? Viscosity, you know, density, these kind of things. And if these properties sort of affect virus penetration and virus infection. So once we have this information, we can probe for these specific properties for a new virus or for a specific animal population or even a specific person. So this goes towards kind of a diagnostics and towards the development of a biomarker. So can we relate certain characteristics of mucus for the person or the animal being more likely to be infected? So basically saying maybe your mucus is different from my mucus, or your mucus is more antiviral than my mucus. We might understand why that is and if we can change these properties. The big bottom line is that we want to understand that barrier, how it works, and how we can understand and maybe focus on specific properties to make it more efficient.
As we heard, you have many collaborative projects with national and international partners. What does collaboration mean to you, and what can we maybe learn from research for our society?
Collaboration is very central in the scientific community. So this really starts here in the group. So we collaborate with each other. People have different projects, different interests, different expertise. And it is very important to have this diversity, because then we really get new ideas. We can really fill our knowledge gaps. We fill gaps in our projects where, you know, I don't know how to do this. Can you help me? So this really starts, here close by. And then it is really transferred into the scientific community, where we need really dedicated expertise. So let's say our group is good in microscopy, so we do that. We need other groups that maybe can work with animals, or people that work in the clinic, so they have contact with human patients and can give us maybe human mucus, for example. So these projects really live and only live because of collaborations, and that is very central. And I try to give this kind of spirit also into our group. Our group is also diverse, and people work in diverse projects. They have all kind of collaborations where they work with other people from other disciplines also. So very interdisciplinary, so that you learn how to speak each other's language and really advance scientific projects. I think this is very, very much the key. Otherwise, we would not really move forward that quickly. So we couldn't really entertain these projects that I mentioned without having diverse interdisciplinary collaborations.
So this is something that we could take with us for our society, for our living together.
I think, you know, it's being open to other ideas, to what other people think, what they have to say. And also what they are good at and what they know, so that we try to be open, communicate open, we don't judge. And that brings us forward, that allows these collaborations. And that's really what brings also the fun in our daily life, because we have a diverse group of people. You know, here at HZI, we have a number of different people next door. We just talk to each other. We see each other at lunch. And then, you know, from one to the other, things happen, and suddenly we have maybe a new angle to study a certain aspect of infection biology that was not really possible before.
What is your long-term goal for your research? What do you like to have achieved someday?
Yeah, so our team is still fairly young, and our group is fairly young, so we have developed some new concepts, and we try to push those forward. You know, we talked about the nano infection biology, so we want to understand how viruses work at the scale of sort of a virus and of single proteins, so that we want to establish that in the scientific community. That would be one I think, wish. And then it's the transfer also and the translation. We have talked a lot about the Mucus project, which is a very translational project, or it has sort of stronger translational aspect. I think most of what we do is still very much basic science, understanding virus entry. So if some of these aspects could manifest themselves in kind of, you know, other directions, maybe become either an antiviral or a new diagnostic tool, or, you know, things like that, that would be nice to have. And maybe 5 or 10 years, maybe we'll have a mucus chip. You know, we can sample your mucus and my mucus, and we can tell, you know, very quickly if we should get a flu vaccine or not. I think that would be a nice goal to achieve.
Sounds really nice. So when I'm talking to you and when I'm listening to you, I really hear in your voice and how you're talking that you're really into your research, but you need to have some free time, I think. What do you do to relax from work?
My family is sort of the big counter pole, so we spend a lot of time together. We do things together with my wife and my kids. And so I wouldn't say I have really active hobbies at the moment. I'm interested in sports, so I do sports to work out. I'm interested in comics and video games, this kind of stuff. I wouldn't call it a hobby, but it's like interest where I try to get, away from or put the thoughts on other things. But I think the counterpole is the family that naturally brings you to other, you know, things, or puts your mind on other things.
At the end, do you have a take home message for us all?
Yeah, I think it's important for us to appreciate the world we live in, you know, in terms of infectious diseases for now, that, you know, we live in this world together with other people, with animals and our environment. And it's important to keep an eye on all those, and that they are interconnected, and that we have seen this, you know, we have these spillover events, for example, if we think about zoonotic viruses. So this is one part, just to appreciate this and how they affect each other. We haven't really talked about climate change, for example. So our environment, you know, is also part of this whole global environment that really determines how virus or how infectious diseases spread. So that's maybe one thing just to think about and to appreciate. And then also to appreciate that there is a large scientific research community that tries to understand how these things work. So we know what we are doing. We are good at this. We have large centers like HZI, which have really a large collaborative communities where we can very focused and very interdisciplinary drive projects forward to understand infectious diseases very quickly. So to really help each and every one. So I would hope that people know this, appreciate this, and have trust in what we do, and that we will try to make the next pandemic less severe, or, you know, faster understand and develop countermeasures.
Thank you for your time and the exciting talk about viruses and mucus.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you very much. It was a lot of fun.
Professor Christian Sieben researches how viruses interact with the cells of our mucous membrane to infect them, so we can get ahead of them maybe in the future.